Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs again. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's episode of Wandering DMs, how do you handle unexpected things in your game or your session or your live stream talk show on Sunday? All that and more at Wandering DMs, particularly yeah. Blowing up your whole campaign with like unexpected things or a time warp or a nuke or something like that.
Yeah, or unexpected things like the stream not working and us having to start all over again.
A good example. Paul, let me ask you a question. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, the stream not working is definitely not a good thing. But, is it a good thing or a bad thing for your campaign is what we were talking about, right? When everything just goes wrong, the players do something crazy, and, how do you react? What do you do? I think it's a great thing. Generally, I think it's a really good thing. I have examples of where it didn't go well, where it did not work, but I do think it is the best thing. Okay, great. Our folks on our chat are telling us that everything's working again. Thank you so much. What an episode for things to go wrong in.
And see how we pivot and handle them.
There you go.
I think that was okay. You know what? It's a cooperative exercise. If we didn't have a team of players with us, Paul, we would have had a lot more trouble around that.
Yep,
so it is really
true.
That's why you have a team together in order to work through the interesting, challenging parts, which is why we're all here.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. So we have a couple of different examples in our history, I think, of this happening where either through TPK or through odd player behavior that no one saw coming, like the campaign goes or the game goes in a crazy direction, and the DM has to take a moment and go, how do I deal with this?
Right.
And historically for me, I'm gonna pick on our friend Adam here a bunch, Dan. Because historically, sorry, Adam, if you're watching this, also not sorry. The funny thing is this, I remember this happening a lot all the way back into college with Adam in particular at the helm as DM.
Okay.
Because we would intentionally as players do this to him. Orchestrated it to him because Adam is a great improviser, but he's also a meticulous preparer. And so he would create these very elaborate campaigns up front, and then we saw it as our job to try and throw away all that hard work and get him to a point where he had to improvise. And I feel a little bad about it these days, honestly. Back in the day, I thought it was hilarious. And now looking back, I'm like, man, he put so much effort, and we just said, screw you! And coordinated. There was one particular game that really sticks out in my head, although I do think we did it a lot in a lot of different games to him. There was one game in particular where he had established, I'm going to run this game. It's going to be set in sort of Viking Nordic era setting. And I'm going to call it a session zero here. We didn't call it session zero back then. This is the 90s. I'm going to meet with each player individually and establish your character. And then we're going to all join together and play. And so all the players got together and all decided collectively that we were all going to make characters from tropical regions, from specifically characters who were as polar opposite to his setting as possible and all in the same way. And one by one, we told them about our characters. And we developed our characters a little bit to try and give them interesting different personalities. And so it took him maybe two or three of those sessions before he went, wait a minute, you guys are screwing with me. And I think we were right. We were, and part of it was that we were dicks, and we thought it was funny to screw with Adam in that way. But part of it came from, I think, from a real place of understanding. Maybe not in this. We didn't actually talk about it. That I think in this kind of open way that you and I talk about stuff in the show now.
Right.
But I think we sort of understood that Adam was at his best when he improvised, and we were trying to force him into that role. And the interesting thing is, these days, he's a big fan of story games and systems in general that force him to do this. Like, I think he's recognized that this is his strength, and he needs to play games that push him in that direction rather than fight against it.
Right. Fascinating. Well, I'd say that's a happy outcome.
It is
that's
a happy outcome, right? And we have these funny stories from college of where we were just total jerks to him. So sorry that we were total jerks to you, Adam, but I hope it was an enriching experience.
I'd like to know a specific example of what Adam did to respond to one of those things. Like, what did he do with all the tropical characters in a supposed Nordic campaign?
Honestly, that was the most extreme case, right? He did his best to run with it, honestly. He did his best to run with it. By the time the last player came to him, he said, no, you're not playing this character. You guys are just screwing with me. I need at least one character who's going to be set in the setting and going to care. Okay. So he strong-armed that person into making a character that fit in the setting. And then when we all got together, all the other players turned on that character and were like, you're the devil, we don't understand you, and we attacked him and killed him.
What?
Yeah. So that whole campaign just completely imploded because we were in a weird place, and that's what happened. But there are other games where I've seen him roll with it, right, frankly, and say, okay, well, like, this was the joke at the time was that he would have all this prepared material and he'd say, not using that, and then he would start to make it up on the fly, and that's when the games got good. I think that's when the games got really exciting and fun. I'm trying to think of specific examples where that happened. It's hard. This is a long. I mean, I'm reaching back into like 20 years, and so of course the moment that sticks in my memory is the one where it was an utter failure. Is that with the Islanders? I'm trying to think of cases where I have more recent cases where I can tell you that things did work well.
But before we skip to that, it's interesting because I had a note here that I wasn't sure whether it was would it fit into this discussion, but it's basically just what you said. High school, right? High school seems like a time for this because maybe for people of our age, because when I was in high school, I had the exact same phenomenon happening to me as DM. And it didn't happen before. I mean, we've been playing my friend started playing in elementary school, and we were playing through junior high school, and we played the whole classic Giants Drow series up through I think like junior high school, actually freshman year. And then after that, it became much harder, and like we were all kind of going through the pre-planned adventures, I guess. And it was after that stuff got much harder to keep on track, so to speak. And I tried running Temple of Elemental Evil, and for some reason, when we got to that age, the same thing happens. My players kind of ferociously avoided following the pre-planned adventures. And one thing I would say is kind of an interesting thing in things that Gygax wrote is, you know, obviously the game is Dungeons and Dragons, and we expect to be exploring a dungeon, the most classic thing. But in each of Gary Gygax's, you know, introductory adventures, and I'm thinking Keep on the Borderlands, and I'm thinking Village of Hamlet, he starts off by preparing this really elaborate community, right? Preparing this really elaborate, detailed village that takes up fully half of your introductory adventure. Keeping the Borderlands, half of the things to keep, and the other half's the evil caves. Village of Hamlet, well, I mean, just from the title, the majority of that book is actually the village with all the peasants and inns and taverns and shopkeepers. And fairly, I think the minority of the adventure is the ruined moat house that you can go adventure in. And so it's interesting that if you actually literally use that, for people that have never played D&D before, and you just go by the book, they walk into the village the first thing, and your players do not know what to do, right? As far as they know, D&D is about fighting things. So in both cases, my introductory first day player goes and just picks some shopkeeper and starts fighting them. Right? Absolutely. Yeah. So like, the first time I ever ran Keep on the Borderlands, it was a solo game. I had one person running, you know, two people. They go in, they find the church, and they actually try to mug the fairly high-level priest that's in the church, right? And they get beat down, and they get thrown in the dungeon of the keep. And as far as I know, that's where they still are.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For me, it's canonical that the first ever characters that went through the keep are still rotting away in the dungeon of the keep. If anybody ever goes and thinks that. So I've had that issue of having introductory players just attack the village.
Well,
and the response has been to just punish them, and that's the end of the character because of that.
right. And likewise, I have some examples here where their response is to create inter-party conflict, where the party themselves just turn on each other and just, and the whole game just collapses because the players can't get along.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's interesting, though, that you bring up Hamlet and Keep on the Borderlands, and I would throw into the bucket my personal favorite, The Secret of Bone Hill, which, again, I still to this day use that module as a starting kicking off point for campaigns. For my current campaign, I did. And the first thing I rip out of it is the dungeon part. The first thing I say is, I don't actually want the keep that's on Bone Hill with the levels and the monsters. Let me get rid of that piece. What I want is the town and the surrounding wilderness, and that's like a good starting point for a sandbox experience. And it's interesting
because, you know, inspired by Bone Hill, actually, I tried to make my own wilderness of the same type, and it was ugly. It was a nasty, chalky bunch of miserable, uninteresting nonsense. So it's interesting that it is a great wilderness setting, and it's motivational, and I was certainly unable to follow up on the same kind of thing, honestly. I don't know how he did that.
I think you need a fair amount of random input to make that sort of thing. The best I've encountered, and we're off on a bit of a tangent, but the best I've encountered is there's a Warhammer Fantasy 2nd Edition book called the... I don't remember the title, but it's the one that's about the Border Princes. And specifically, if you go into that book, you will find that it is just chock full of random tables for generating a sandbox, right? The whole point is like, oh, it's the Border Princes. It's a whole bunch of little tiny kingdoms that all have their own stuff going on. And so here are a whole bunch of tables to generate a couple of, and not just one, but like two or three neighboring provinces that are warring with each other for control. It's delightful. And if you just follow it by the book, you'll come up with an amazing, amazing sort of setting for that stuff.
Great.
Definitely recommend that one. But let me go back to the reason I think it's interesting that you bring all that up is I think that, right, we talked about how the way out of this trap is improvisation. And I think that also then brings us to what I call the myth of the no prep game. So there was a time, probably in the fairly recent past, probably in earlier episodes of this very show, where I've said something like, my goal is to have no prep, or I don't prep for my games, or something along that lines. And it's kind of a myth, because of course I prep. Of course I do prep. But I don't specifically prep for the upcoming game or specifically prep for the campaign. The prep is more in the creation of small reusable elements, right? So between generating a big world where there's just a lot of stuff going on, or honestly, I think of the boss fight for breakfast games as a bit of prep for campaign play.
Right.
So for those who don't know, our upcoming our upcoming web show, The Big Bad, was originally based on a convention game that we used to play called Boss Fight for Breakfast, which was specifically a thing that we made for conventions where we're trying to figure out how do I fit a D&D experience into just 2 hours for the breakfast crowd, just pre-lunch. We want to play a quick game. And we whittled it down to just like, well, one big complex encounter. We're going to jump to the boss fight. We're just going to go right to the boss fight and have this very complicated encounter, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So I've run a bunch of those, and now I have this lovely library of those, and now I have them. That's the prep, right? That is the prep. I have all those things in my holster now, ready to pull out. That's my, sometimes I've made the metaphor of like my DMing style is like quilting, right? I have all these pieces, and I'm just trying to figure out how to tie them together. So for me, the prep for a campaign
that's a really interesting thing. That's one of the really interesting things is that, you know, maybe get pre-made adventures and tie them together is kind of the most interesting part. Getting the details, which I think is what you need to prep for sometimes, that for me, that's the hard part sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. So prep the details, right? Like definitely do that and practice, right? Run them at conventions or run them as one-off games with other folks. Yeah. And then you can say like, great, I have all these dungeons and I'm prepared to then twist and warp them into the campaign as needed so that when the players do something crazy, I can look around and say, well, what pieces do I have and how do I build that?
Right.
And then I have a very specific story about where exactly I did that, which I can get into if you want.
You know, let me put a pin in that because before we should before we get off, because we've had quite a bit of interesting chat that I wish I could get to entirely, which we probably don't have time for. But before I totally get off the issue of like players intentionally derailing your campaign. So I think it was William a while back who said there's two different ways a campaign gets blown up is unintentionally, maybe by the dice, versus players intentionally, you know, fighting against your railroad, maybe.
Yep.
And I will say that I had, when I was in high school, my players didn't take up the offer, right? So there was a point whereby with Temple of Elemental Evil, they made the decision of like, well, that's just too dangerous. We're not going to do that. We're going to rob villagers instead. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I tried to pivot that and I was like, I was reading that and I was like, okay, well, apparently we're interested in an evil campaign, I guess. I'm going to give you banditry opportunities. And they just avoided all of that as well.
Yep.
And it's interesting that at the time there wasn't this emphasis. So I think William pointed out really the solution to this is have a conversation away from the table about what we all want from the games.
Yep.
And that was certainly not in my toolkit at the time.
Yeah.
That was not something that was in that was probably a failing of the original first edition books when you know Gary what he wrote was punish them in the game, have lightning bolts come down and strike the character that's doing that. And you know, maybe I should be reading that as a joke and I didn't at the time, but I do agree that the ideas nowadays of like you ought to sit down and have a conversation about really the general direction you want is something that I was overlooking and I did not have in my toolkit at the time. And people are correct that that's what you want to do now.
Let me give you another example from our own personal history, Dan, which maybe you will have not remembered. It's a little more recent, but I think still at that point where maybe we didn't have that tool in our toolbox, I was running a Deadlands campaign or a couple mini sessions of Deadlands. And I can't remember exactly who played who, but somebody played a Native American character and somebody played like a pioneer or cowboy character. And, you know, obviously they're going to have their differences. And the adventure I was set to run was actually kind of a mystery adventure. So there's going to be a bunch of investigation. And the hope was that it follows the classic Deadlands arc of, oh, we're just in classic Wild West. Okay, something spooky's going on. Oh, gosh, it's supernatural and horrible and we have to deal with it. However, when I ran that game, those two characters decided that we've got to be true to my character. I hate that other guy.
Yeah.
I think you were one of the players. I think you were one of the two characters involved in this.
Well, I don't.
Were you?
Think,
no.
Okay. No, but because I remember when I was playing, I was actually playing an old time veterinarian.
Okay. Oh, right.
I was playing an old time horse doctor. Okay. Yeah.
So it must have been two of the other players who had played those two characters, who just basically went after each other. They just we ran one session of it, I think. And the whole adventure was just, like, I was trying desperately to inject elements of the actual adventure into the game.
Right.
And they were just, nope, we're going to kill each other. And the whole thing became that. And by the end, I was like, well, we never even got to the adventure. I don't know if you guys had fun or not, but I don't know where to take this anymore. Because clearly you're not buying into the adventure and you're just enjoying killing each other, so forget it.
It's an interesting dilemma because, you know, if we read like the oldest old school stuff of, you know, Dave Arneson's Blackmoor campaign, you know, coming from a war game origin, the players were running competing baronies to begin with. And so there was conflict or competition at the very least is baked into the origin of the game. But I got to admit, those sessions aren't super fun. Those sessions aren't super fun when it's just we're gonna bitch and fight each other. I don't like those, and I think right before we got started, I actually threw out my thesis of you gotta part of your job at the table is to come up with a reason why you are cooperating with the other people at the table.
Right.
That's part of your job.
Right. I mean, this is too many thoughts. I'll fire at the same time. Stack overload. Darn it. Okay. So in terms of the competition in the early days, right? I feel like possibly they didn't do these kind of like setting the tone, you know, or just talk with the players and figure out that we're all on the same page, because there was only one page, right? Like there was an assumption that this is the kind of game we're playing. And possibly the adversarial role was really the DM, right? That the players are like, well, we have to work together or he's going to kill us.
Well, I mean, you just described all my games right now.
Right. So I feel like possibly, I don't know if this session ever happened, but possibly in the old days you might have had a session where the players are like, oh, we're going to have inter-party conflict. We're going to kill each other. And DM goes, great, you just did my job for me. Okay, everyone's dead. New character.
I gotta make a note of that. That's great. That's great. But we've had times, right, where someone wants the, and you know, I understand this. Like, you look at a lot of TV shows, you look at a lot of books, and there's you know, the main character is on stage. It's about their inter conflict, right? Mm-hmm. And so in some cases, you kind of have to have that conversation about, no, you're a team against a world that is quite likely going to just squash you if you look the wrong way in classic D&D. And so, like, come up with some kind of reason why you're actually cooperating and willing to share and sacrifice and work as a team. And I certainly get irritated when players are the, like, I'm going to steal from everybody. And then, like, other people, well, I need to chase them down and punish them.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people understand, it's a lot more awareness of how destructive that can be nowadays than at one point.
Well, also, I mean, just the genre is wider, right? Like, if we're sitting down to a role-playing game, there are so many, right? There's a lot more than D&D these days.
Well, yeah.
And even within D&D, there's a lot of ways to run it, right? There's a lot of different ways you can run that game. And so I feel like, now more than ever, we need to set those expectations early, because just sitting down saying, hey, we're all going to play D&D is not enough, right? You have not explained to me what the activity is.
It pains me. As an old school guy, it pains me. And, you know, the amount of text that I need to put in my description of what we're doing grows all the time. And you're right, I can't just say, we're playing D&D because it means many, many things to many different people. And again, my expectation of, like, I'm playing original D&D, basically 1974, that doesn't actually connote meaning to a lot of people. Like, I know what that means, I think.
Right.
I'm getting to know what that means, but it's a good point, and it kind of aggravates me, but we have to have some kind of explanation nowadays,
All right, let's dig into some examples then of when we saw a game blow up and it went well. Because we at the beginning of this, we said it's fantastic, and now we've done nothing but illustrate all the terrible cases where it failed and we had terrible games.
And maybe what we're doing now, we're pivoting from, you know, interpersonal problems, which really wasn't our headline, to unexpected surprises for everybody at the table, where we're all there for the same kind of game, and something happens, or a decision gets made, or the dice show up and surprises all of us in an interesting way.
Yep. Okay, great. So I've got a couple on my list. So why don't I talk a little bit about the Silk Guild? So if you search my blog for the Silk Guild, you'll find my write-up on this, but I'll try to condense that really quickly here. Basically, I was using Jeff Riance's carousing rules at my game, and at the very end of a session, the players sat down and they all rolled on the carousing table, and one of them failed the carousing check and got the result of, you join a cult or secret society, right? That's the gist. And it was at the very end of the session. And so I said something like, okay, well, you see your friend Tom, you know, wander off to a bar with somebody and then you lose track of him. We'll figure out what that means next session. And then I forgot about it. I literally didn't think about it at all for a week. And I get to the table the next week and I'm like, oh crap, I never made something up for that. And the guy who was playing Tom was absent. And so I came to the table with this expectation of, like, all right, well, we'll just hand wave it. Oh, he's wandered off. Don't worry about it. You guys, the players will do something else. They'll continue following some lead, and we'll worry about what happened to Tom later. No. They said, well, we ask around what happened to Tom. And so I made up one detail. I'm like, let me give them one memorable detail. I said, he was seen at this tavern with a man in a purple turban. This very memorable physical description, perhaps too much. Because they latched onto turbans.
Absolutely.
Who do you see wearing a turban? That's really unusual. So they ran with it. They're like, we got to find the guy with the purple turban. And so they spent a whole session like tracking that down. And then I'm having to make stuff up left and right. I'm like, okay, well, what's the guy with the purple turban? I guess he's a member of the Silk Guild. They wear fancy robes and turbans and stuff to show off their wares. We go find the Silk Guild. I'm like, okay, so I made up this whole little thing. Where I've now put the missing character as the victim that they're going to go rescue from this evil creature that I just, like, flipping through the monster manual, like, Rakshasas are cool, I'm going to put one of those, but I'm going to change it, it's not going to be a tiger head, he's going to have a bull head. And then the players assumed it was a minotaur, because why'd you choose a bull head for a Rakshasa? That's weird. Yes, oops, sorry guys. They kill the Rakshasa, they rescue their friend, they bring him back to the tavern, I go, great, they're done, they're going to move on, and they said... They somehow jumped to the conclusion that that was just this one guy's little den, but the Silk Guild itself is a much bigger place, and we need to go infiltrate it and take it down. Great. And I thought they just did that. I'm like looking at my phone, didn't they just do that? Oh no, I have to invent a Silk Guild. And I'm just tearing through my notes. This is all in one session. I'm tearing through my notes, where... Having stuff, I'm like, well, there's this piece of an adventure that has buildings with this, your sort of onion dome roofs, which is kind of exotic and maybe in the right theme. Let me toss that in. Ooh, if I change this monster to an Ifrit, that's kind of, now we're in kind of that weird Arabian theme. And so I'm just literally taking existing stuff and just making little tweaks to it and go, okay, well, I've run this before. And if I just tweak this and tune that, it kind of fits what they want. And they ran with it and they had this wonderful adventure. They go and they you know, and I'm basically yes ending them. They go to the gates and they say, you know, can we come in? And they say, no, you know, strangers are never welcome into the, you know, this is a closed off part of this, of the Silk Guild from a far off realm. This is our sovereign domain. You can't come in. Well, do you ever have any like parties where you invite guests in and show off your wares? And I'm like, yes, of course. Of course we do. And they say, okay, great. In fact, one's happening tomorrow night. Great. The party leaves and then goes and invents this whole way to get themselves invites so they can go to the party. And it continued the whole night, continued to snowball in this way. Whole night. Honestly, the end result is something that I've since then plucked out and now use as a boss fight for breakfast sometimes because it was such gold. It was such a fantastic, fun time. And everyone remembers the night they took on the Silk Guild. And that one party member who was absent kicks himself for having missed it. And I'm like, you're the reason it happened.
Which wouldn't have happened. You know, now that you mention it, I think that maybe among my favorite moments in a D&D session is the moment where the DM and the facial expression that you just had when you delivered that is right on point. Because the moment of, yes, I'm not happy about it, but yes, obviously that happens, and now I'm committed to that bullshit. Yep. Yes, and I'm not happy about it, but that's what's happening, so okay, here it comes.
I think that's a really important DM skill, to recognize when you're unhappy with the direction a thing has gone, but you look around the table and you see everyone is excited. Right. If the whole table is excited and leaning in and engaged, they're right and you're wrong.
Fair point. I mean, for me, it's like you've made an argument, and I didn't see it coming, and I have to accept it because your logic is ironclad and great. Now everything's broken. Thank you very much. Great. So that's kind of the direction. I think that's the direction I swing in. Is like you have actually convinced me that what I was perceiving was incorrect. That's really marvelous. I think it's funny because I think we were at a convention a year ago or so, and it was with you and our friend Adam, actually. I think we were walking between buildings at some point, I think, for dinner. And I think I remember saying, because like the bit about the very specific and memorable purple turban kind of being the trigger point for, like, obviously there's some details here that we really want to follow up on. And I find that likewise, when I come up with stuff, live in a live session that I never, ever would have. I mean, I guess that my brain is in a different mental state, that if I, if sat at my computer for months on end. I never would have come up with that detail. And all of a sudden, I find it just like springing out of myself. And this is true, honestly, both for, you know, live D&D sessions and also even for teaching, is I wind up having phrases come out of my mouth and me going, that is kind of really lovely and poetic. Who the hell came up with that? Yeah. Because I never would have thought that up normally, even though I hear myself saying it. And I sometimes kick myself because I wind up giving away too much. Like I remember like a particular game session and our characters were like, well, where's this gem come from? We take it to a sage and they do some stuff. And now here I am. Okay, I guess I'm coming up with background for a gem, I guess. And I'm like, well, gems come in many types. And there's a rumor that there's an enormous orc empire on an island hundreds of miles away. And the rumor is they had three gems and they were the magical keys to their treasury. And they locked the treasury with the magical gems. And then the gems were stolen. They haven't been able to get into the treasury again for years and years. Where are the gems? And like afterwards, I'm like, my God, where I now look at all that stuff that I just made up. And the players are like, well, apparently that's the campaign that Dan has set out.
Yep.
Is the campaign with the gems and the treasury we need to go quest after. And I'm like, oh, for God's sake, what have I just stumbled into now?
I mean, those are definitely the moments where you know you're doing it right, where you have a conversation with the players later and they go, wait, you made that up on the spot? And you're like, yep. So here's my question though, like, okay, so we agree that's delightful and wonderful and we love when it happens. How do we make it happen more?
Well, that's an interesting question. I got to admit, I have mixed emotions about the big, because frankly, I was like that particular example. I really was actually kicking myself after because I changed the tone. I wanted like small scale, gritty, you know, fantasy. And I'd accidentally changed the tone into like epic quest land. So that actually did really have mixed emotions about whether I should restrain myself on that kind of thing more in the future or not. Interesting, but let's say that's a good thing. Let's say I'm crazy for that, and that's a good thing, and we should try to make that happen more often. I don't know, Paul. Prep less? I don't know.
No, see, I think again, like, it's just prep different. I think is the answer. Prep different. Prep pieces, and be prepared to change the pieces. Right. So here's a nice little 3-room dungeon, or a 5-room dungeon, or a 10-room dungeon. Right. So have a couple of those, and be prepared to say like, well, this one features a manticore, but I could change it to an owlbear or a dragon. Yeah. Sure. That, you know, right. So if you have a couple of those kind of in your repertoire, and so you have bits and pieces to make something from, I think that's a good step. You could do that. And then I would also recommend use tables, right? Have more tables, random tables, because random tables are a great way to inject the madness.
Yeah.
Right. Like, whether it's the carousing rules, or I remember also we did one of my summer birthday games that we held, Max was asking what his motivation was, and I said, ha ha ha, I have a table for that, and I rolled on this table, and I got the delightful response of, you know, why am I going in this dungeon? Well, because your parents have been abducted and are being held at ransom unless you find and retrieve the Star of Umamgarash. And I'm like, what is that? And then I injected a whole thing into that adventure to feed that motivation, right? He's like, I got to find the Star of Umamgarash, and I got to go find it, and I got to save my parents. And I'm like, okay, this is, let me, then I'm flipping through the adventure and looking for where can I inject that piece, that random element that wasn't here before. Gotcha. And again, if you have a couple of things, oh, okay, well, this, here's an ogre mage. He could have the star on him. Sure,
it's interesting, shove it in there. And you're suggesting, like, because I was about to ask, like, specifically how big are the pieces that you're talking about? And so you said you uttered the words 5 to 10 rooms, which is interesting because classically, I think classic tournament adventures, and honestly, what I find all the time still is we, in a 4-hour session, we tend to get about to 7 notable major encounters, like around 7. Which is weird because there's that psychological principle of the magic 7 ±2, which is about what people can hold in their short-term memory. So it's kind of weird that in a standard session, we get to about seven interesting encounters. Now, for me, sometimes it's hard to get on that tip because that's exactly the opposite of the advice in all the classic books, where Gary was thinking about mega dungeon, one single giant mountain mega dungeon with hundreds and hundreds and thousands of rooms and dozens of levels. And that's everything that all the text in original D&D and first edition talks about.
Yep.
And even BX, really, right? Yep. They don't talk about, you know, seven room encounters.
But again, I think you can, part of this is just my preference for, I like that.
Right.
Generally, the campaigns I run are big open wilderness campaigns with many small dungeons, not one giant mega dungeon. I think you can do it with a mega dungeon. But I think that you then just have to segment your mega dungeon, right? So, for example, the best case of that I can think of is, of course, the Dyson's Delve, which is sort of a mini mega dungeon. Right? Mm-hmm. And again, it's very easy to say, like, well, I'm just going to tack on this sub-level here. I'm just going to add these couple of rooms there, right? And it helps that the way that I look at that mega dungeon in particular is that it's very segmented by factions. And I think that's what makes a mega dungeon interesting to me, is when there are many different factions. And so really all you've done is kind of invert what I just said of saying, well, instead of having a big open wilderness with lots of little dungeons, you have lots of little dungeons that are connected on a common underground superstructure.
Right, right. Interesting take. Dyson's Delve is really nice for that size, honestly. It's easy to get into. They tend to fit in about a session.
But I think you get the same thing with, say, like Michael Curtis's Stonehell, which is much bigger. But again, he subdivides. He subdivides by level and then quadrant. Every level has four quadrants, and every quadrant becomes... Now, his quadrants are still pretty big. I think they're more in like the 20 to 30 room size.
Right.
But they're still digestible. And I could see saying, okay, I'm going to replace this quadrant with this, or I'm going to alter this quadrant in this way.
Right. Now, one of our commenters on Twitch there, I think it's Jameis Ed, if I'm pronouncing that right, is pointing, and I totally 100% agree. I could not agree with this more. Like, even with the old mega dungeons, the assumption is you'd go in and you'd go out in one session, and I actually mandate that to this day in all my campaign games. It's absolutely, you go in, and I, you know, I frankly, I do keep numbers, and you're totally right. You get to around 5, 6, 7 notable encounters as you're exploring there. I require the players to get back out to a safe place like the village. And then again, among the things that does for me is it wipes out the whole issue of what happens when a player doesn't show up sometime. Is, well, then they're just not there. They're hanging out in the inn drinking. They just don't come on the next session. And I see that dilemma come up over and over again online. Like, what do you do when a player isn't there? Do you run the character? Does somebody else? Mm-hmm. And frankly, like, I wasn't going to cause a debate, but I saw someone on Twitter saying the DM runs the character and we promise they cannot die. We promise many things can happen, but they absolutely cannot die. And I had, you know, that triggered me a little bit because I was like, God. Just don't have them there.
The best way to ensure they don't die is that they're just not there at all.
Right. I totally agree. For me, it works. It solves so many problems to mandate you've got to get out at the end of the session and have a clean start and a clean finish to each session. So I agree that that's in my mega dungeon, that's totally how we have to play.
Great.
Yeah. Joshua, thank you.
That comment was from our friend Joshua, I've always read his online handle as J'amused, as a sort of like, it's missing apostrophe for a French. Nice. Yeah. I am amused.
That's nice.
But I bet I'm totally wrong. Anyway, Joshua will correct us.
Well, I hope that's it. I really hope that's it now. Now, on that, there you go. Perfect. You, as usual, Paul, you're ahead of me on that. Now that's bringing me. So we're not going to get to everything
we never do.
you know, the funny thing is that what's happening to us right now is exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Is that the sessions, the Wandering DMs shows where Paul and I come on with less prepared, and we in advance say, I'm really worried about this one because I have way less prepared than normal, turn out to be the most robust and overflowing cornucopia of ideas that we have, bizarrely. Because now we have all kinds of things that are connected. So let me just jump to this. So, and this is something that Paul pointed out, and this was not on my list to begin with, but right before the show, Paul said, well, what about that Rappin' Athic game that you ran a couple of years ago? So we had a weekend long, I think for your birthday, game with Bill Webb's Rap and Affic, and I got it, and nobody else had read it at the time. And I got the OSR version for, it was for Swords and Wizardry, but I'm going to run it with Original Edition Delta. And, you know, it's huge, right? It's huge. So it's Bill, you know, Bill Webb and company wrote that over 20 plus years. It's enormous. There's no way you can get to that in a year. Yep. And I've got like maybe three long days is what we have. So I'm thinking, I look at it, I make characters a particular level. I think I started off with like fourth level characters. Also, you guys said, let's all make wizards. Thank you very much. So, of course, that was an additional kick in the nuts, yeah, thing, which ties into the, like, let's see if we can scramble things up for Dan. Wonderful.
Yep.
And what I've done beforehand is I've very carefully analyzed the number of monsters in the different areas and what the threat level is and how many players I have and what level characters I'm making. I'm like, so they ought to be able to get to maybe the first three levels, right? Maybe levels 1, 2, 3, 4. So I carefully prep, and I have miniatures made. Actually, I have miniatures available, and I have physical props for some of the setting. Like at the bottom of level 4, there's a sub chapel, I think, with a sub priest in the complex. And so I make miniature terrain to roll out for that. And I've analyzed strategies, yep, and I know what the tricky parts as you come in, the dangerous parts, and I'm ready to handle that. And there's multiple entrances to Rap and Affic.
Yep.
And as you know, there's a well that says in no uncertain terms, whatever you do, don't go down the well. And there's rumors that you get, don't go down the well. And it's inscribed on the well, don't go down the well. And there's giant demon claw marks on the outside of the well, don't go down the well. So, of course, the way that got blown up is you guys went, well, we've got to go down the well.
Yeah.
Clearly, there's no way that all these rumors and warnings could be so ridiculously over the top if that wasn't the place you're supposed to go. And absolutely, you guys went down the well.
Now, for what it's worth, three out of three experiences I've had with Rap and Affic, the players perceive don't go down the well as a challenge.
Right.
And they go down the well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I tried so hard. I was like, no, I'm serious. And I'm like, you know, and so I think at the table, I think, look, I'm serious, guys. And you really shouldn't go down the well. And, you know,
and our response is, Dan's screwing with us. We're going down the well.
Right. And I was like, oh, Dan's getting to be a somewhat better actor or worse. I don't know which direction that goes in anymore. I have no control over that. But the more honest and sincere I try to be about, no, you're really going to, everybody's really convinced. Everybody in the entire campaign world is convinced, seriously, don't go down the well. Anyway, make a long story short, the way it's written, the well takes you to an area for ninth level characters, right? It immediately drops you to the ninth level or something like that, or there's a thing and then there's a side path.
I seem to recall we even then doubled down. Like, we found another spot where that went even deeper.
Absolutely.
And we went, yes, please.
That's,
and we went even deeper.
That's absolutely what happened. I think, right, I'm shortcutting, but very quickly, within a couple of hours, you know, you were on the ninth level of Rap and Affic.
Way over our heads.
And so, I have not done any pre-prep for it. So I'm scrambling through. So I actually had, I think I had like a paper document, and I just had to pitch that out because I hadn't printed out. It's like, you know, 300 pages or something like that. So fortunately, I had the whole thing on my tablet, and I'm running through the digital tablet version, trying to get to areas that I've never seen before. And I'm not saying it's perfect. You know, we got bogged down in a maze that I didn't think through to begin with, and stuff like that at one point. But, and I'm like, well, all right. So they're clearly on a death wish. They're on a death wish. They're completely suicidal. Now they're on the seventh level. Clearly, they're all going to die. And I was completely committed. I'm like, they're going to die, and we're going to have to make up new characters. And I will say, look, no, seriously, you're going to stick on the higher levels because this is way over your head. And somehow, miraculously, you guys kept defeating things. You kept being victorious.
Through just dumb luck, I think. Yeah.
Well, you know, and you know, like, here's the now you're in the hall of the Minotaur King, and there's a bunch of giant double-sized minotaurs, and they also teleport, right? They also have teleporting magic.
Yep.
And I'm like, clearly you're going to die now. And you pull out, you know, the right charm, and you charm the king and tell the other guys to run away or something like that. And I'm like, okay, I guess that's it. Now, among the thing that's happening, and I think you asked me beforehand if I was going on you, and I absolutely wasn't, right? I absolutely wasn't. Every single turn, I was like, well, this is the moment where I'm going to finally paste them into jelly and we're going to restart. And finally, the burden, the anxious burden will be lifted from my shoulders because finally they're going to get pasted here. And I hadn't prepared the strategies quite as well as I had other times.
I have to interrupt you because talk about the unexpected. Yeah. I'm certain I just saw an ice cream truck drive down the road. And it is late September in New England. I'm wearing a flannel. The heat is on. What is happening?
Are you sure, Paul? Okay, look, from the science right now, Paul and I have debated whether or not it's hot about three times last week. Because, Paul, I'm sweating. I'm sweating. I did have to have the AC on before I turned it off for the show here. And yes, I am currently sweating. It is 80 degrees in my room, right? It is too hot. It's too hot. And an ice cream truck just drove by, Paul. So you should go outside and see how hot it is, because I don't think you actually know how hot it is.
I think we need to send the ice cream truck down south to you.
I would like that. It's way too hot. I just want my brow because I'm like, jeez.
Felt so delightful for our topic of unexpected strange things. What? And I'm wondering if my mic is picking it up. Do you hear the gentle chimes?
I do, actually. I do. In fact, I thought that was over here. So thanks. So David is telling us the temperature in Toronto. Thank you. Thank you for us who have lived in the northern, either northern U.S. or southern Canada. It's too hot for this time of year. It's too hot.
Anyway, regardless of the temperature, sorry, I interrupted your rap and ethics story. And we are getting close to time here, so we're just going to wrap it up for folks, right? Like, ultimately, we had an amazing, thrilling encounter. I remember the group being in tears with laughter at the end result. And a little bit, I was wondering, is Dan, like, taking it easy on us? Because we knew we were in over our heads. It was towards the end of the weekend. We knew we were in over our heads. We knew that we were making bad choices by this point. We were like, no, just keep pushing. Just keep pushing. Just go, 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 go. And had a key moment, I think, at the very end where we're like, High Priest is there and he's got all his minions and horrible monsters. Yeah. And we have this one gambit of send in an invisible wizard to cast Charm Person on the High Priest. And the High Priest miraculously rolls a natural one on his save. And it worked! And we, like, took all his treasure and walked out.
Because I prepared the mini chapel on level 4 very carefully. I was like, oh, this will be very dangerous. It'll be very dangerous. The party will be lucky to get out. Flash forward, they're on level 9. They're on the major ultra temple. There's not a sub priest, but a high priest. He's got two golems. The whole thing has like negative energy in their favor, advantaging their saves and stuff like that. I think it's also a Medusa. And I'm like, great. The campaign will end, and they with a TPK, here's what it's coming. I did actually squash, right? I did actually, in fact, terminate disinvited artist Isabel Garvani, who is my domestic partner, right? Yep. Her character died. Yep. I was not pulling any punches. Yep. And you threw forward the wizard, and I announced what had... It's like, I can only possibly fail this on a 1 or 2, and it absolutely came up a damn 1. Now, at that point, you've got to commit. As the adversary, I'm unhappy, right? Yep. Nothing that I planned or expected is happening. But at that point, you've got to commit. And I was like, great. He's mentally charmed, and you completely dominated him. And he sends his golems into the back room and just starts carting out the whole treasure. Just starts carting out the treasure. And here come chests and tapestries and gold things and cases and scrolls and magic weapons and another tapestry and a magical fountain that always shoots water even when it's disconnected from anything. And of course you had to commit to that. But no, I was absolutely trying to terminate you. Here's my point. I think that you have to actually commit to killing all your characters. That's for me, that's when the most amazing, surprising, memorable stuff happens. If they do go off in a different direction and they decide to go at either a more dangerous place or someplace that is absolutely rumored to just be total death, you kind of have to roll with that as well. And you have to accept when the players choose an option that might result in a TPK. The stakes are high. Assuming you gave them any kind of information to begin with, I think that's fair game. And for me, accepting the stakes of if the players go off, if the players go off in an amazing, risky direction, they might all die. And I think as DM, you kind of have to grab onto that and accept that And even if you're enormously huge fans of your player characters, you have to accept that they've chosen risks and they might get terminated. For me, that's the times when I remember the most when, even despite that, they managed to pull out a victory instead. I absolutely was not, I was not pulling punches in any way and didn't expect that.
Let me just take a step back from that, though, because we're really close to end of time here. The thing, one of the takeaways I have from that experience, when we talk about, like, how do you react to the unexpected, right, when your players just do crazy stuff and you're not prepared. I mean, certainly in this case, it sounds like you learned the lesson of just don't pull the punches, just go, man, go. Just get ready to squash them, which is great.
Yeah.
Now, that game was played over our long weekend of gaming, which by design has several breaks in it, right? We break for meals. Sometimes we go out and we go swimming and whatnot. Likewise, I will I'll point out, let's see, I don't think we got to it, but we had that game with that Max ran for us where we were both players, a Cthulhu game, where you actually literally set off a thermonuclear device.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes,
and Max had to say, I need 5 minutes. He actually had to stop the game and say, listen, we're going to walk away from the table for 5 minutes. Right. I need to figure out what's going to happen. Yeah. And so that's my big piece of advice, whether through plan or just whatever, through happenstance. When you as DM are suddenly taken off guard and you don't know how to move forward, take a break. Like, it's really, really helpful to say, just be honest with your players and say, I didn't foresee this happening. I need a few minutes to process what's happened and come up with what's going to happen next. Let's have a break. I think that's really wise. I would highly recommend doing that.
If you literally have no idea, if you literally actually absolutely have no idea what they just stepped into, I think that's, I think we have both kind of together, you and I, Paul, together have kind of discovered that being important. And I've said it once and didn't really think it was, you know, enormously critical. And you rank kind of picked up the ball and kind of ran with it as being important of this, like, take a break, think it through, give yourself a little space. Totally true. I will say that, you know, like with my experience with Rappanathic, where I actually did have encounters, at least in the book, I hadn't personally read them. You know, there's an interesting meta play in the game whereby maybe, I don't know if it was on your guys' mind, but maybe the players can detect what I have strategically prepared for as DM, right? And maybe you're trying to find the spaces, like the kinks in my armor, where I haven't actually prepared strategically super well and trying to take advantage of the encounters in that case. And maybe the players are intentionally trying to find locations where the DM hasn't super strategically thought through what they're going to do, you know, Keith Amon style, say. I don't know if that was on your mind, but I think it actually did work to your advantage.
I think you're giving the players more credit than due here. Right. I think, you know, possibly the only real psychology going on there is the notion of, we recognize that this is a vacation. This is a weekend away. We're doing something really unusual where we're just playing D&D all weekend for three or 4 days in a row. And, you know, it's similar to what you get in a convention where you're like, this is a convention game. I'm never going to see this character again. Might as well turn it up to 11.
Yeah. That was definitely happening there. And then in that case, as DM, I would say just, you know, jump into it. And I probably forgot some powers and I probably forgot some spells. And I know I got one or two rules wrong.
Yep.
But, you know, just jump in, you know, head first. And those, I got to admit, those are the ones that had the most surprising and the most memorable sessions.
Yeah. So I agree with your statement there of, like, just commit. You know, the players are doing a crazy thing, and you look at it and you go, this is crazy, this is definitely going to kill them. Great, that's what they chose.
Absolutely. If it's a plot point, or there's a MacGuffin, or they get to the MacGuffin case and they open it up and you just had no idea what was in it, take 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Take 5 or 10 minutes and come back and come up with something.
Admittedly, you know, I've had great adventures where the party discovers the MacGuffin or a great treasure or whatever it is, they have something. And then they press their luck and go into an area that's too dangerous for them and lose and die and TPK. And I'm like, great. Now there is a challenging encounter with a treasure that you want.
Right.
Awesome. Right. Fantastic. Right. You've just made content for me. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. My last campaign, I had the big bad that they were chasing around for quite a while. Got into the stronghold. He got away. right? They basically massacred all of his guards, but he actually did manage to narrowly get away. What do I do now? He's not just going to hang out alone in his stronghold. He's going to go to another part of the mega dungeon, take that over, right? Yep. Take that over. And like you just said, now they have extra impetus. Of course, when a bad guy does get away, do it fairly. I would never want to just by fiat say, oh, I want the bad guy to get away because of that, right? Yep. If they catch him, they catch him. That's fine. But now they have extra impetus. They've had eyes on the big treasure. And now they're double interested in getting that other location, try to abscond with that. Yep.
So this happened in my regular Friday game currently, where the players went and encountered a dragon. They encountered a green dragon, a youngish dragon, something that maybe they could have taken, but probably not. They were a little low level at the time. It wiped all but one of them near TPK. One person survived. Every session since then, that one player has been repeatedly telling the party, I know where there's a green dragon. I know he's got a lot of treasure. I know there's a green dragon. Are you ready yet? Are you ready yet? And the feedback he keeps getting is, no, we're not ready. That's going to kill us. We want to go get the green dragon, but we're not ready. And so every time that's happened, I've intentionally put off deciding what's going on over there. I'm like, I'm going to wait until I know for sure that they're going there and say, okay, this much time has passed. What's the green dragon been up to?
Are you going to intentionally up the power of that dragon in order to...
I will not change the dragon itself.
Yeah.
Okay. However, the party definitely had an impact on the surrounding area of what's going on with the dragon. Okay. Yep, and I will have to answer, like what you said, is he just going to sit there and wait for the party to come back and kill him? No, of course not. He's going to do something. Surely something. Find other allies. Leave. I don't know. Something.
It's interesting that a lot of a lot of this goes all the way back even pre-D&D, right? So the whole dungeon concept, right, arguably really comes from Dave McGarry with his dungeon board game inspired by Blackmoor that he playtested for Gary Gygax at one point. And the major thing that happens in Dave McGarry's dungeons, you go in, you fight a monster, and if you lose, the most likely thing is you have to drop a treasure.
Right.
Another monster has more treasure.
Yep.
And boy, that really gets under my skin. Like, that really gets under my skin. If I'm playing dungeon and it happens once, twice, three, four times, and now the goddamn monster now has more treasure than I do that I've been apparently giving away to it. And so I feel like the place, I mean, at least in classic D&D, where people really are motivated is when you're willing to take away the stuff that they love.
Yep.
So either kill a character or take their stuff. And many people say, oh, like losing a magic item or something like that is like the worst thing you can do, and the players are all irritated about it. Good, because they're assuming it's still someplace in the world for them to get back, that's the thing they're going to be most interested in retrieving, is something that they haven't lost.
There's a lot of results on the Jeff Rian's carousing table that are like, the player loses a magic item, the player loses a whole bunch of wealth, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And it's just like by fiat, right? Oh, nope, you went carousing, you lost all this stuff. And I take that as written, but I then take it as a challenge to me to define, well, what happened to it? Because it doesn't stop existing.
I like that.
Right? It doesn't not exist anymore. So that means somebody has my magic item. Who's got my magic item? Can I find them? Can I get it back? Now we've built adventure into the game.
I agree. Great. High risk, high reward. I agree.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Very interesting topic. I know we missed a lot of things. Dan, any final thoughts on blowing up your campaign?
I don't know, man. We'll get to it someday.
Awesome. Well, if you have any thoughts, viewers, on those moments, those glorious moments, or those terrible moments where everything's gone awry, leave us some comments in the video here. Give us your examples or whatnot, or tell us of areas that we've failed to cover, and perhaps we will use that in a future show.
Definitely. And we definitely want to see that. Or if there's anything we touched on that could just spawn into a whole different show, tell us that in the comments. And we would like to follow up on the parts that you find interesting, because we find all of it interesting. Unexpected things that you didn't expect to happen. Very good. Now, remember that, of course, if you're new to the show, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on Twitter and YouTube and Twitch and Facebook. And we are under the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. So please, whichever one is your favorite, please follow us there.
Yes, please do. Likewise, you can listen to our show in audio-only podcast format if you prefer. That can be found on our website at wanderingdms.com and on various carriers such as Google Play and iTunes and Spotify. If you're listening to us on one of those channels, please take a moment to rate and review us. That helps us out.
It definitely does. And as usual, thanks enormously to our patrons who support Wandering DMs. We could not do what we're doing without your generous support. If you would like to join our patrons in supporting Wandering DMs and our upcoming shows, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. We have a special Discord server set up for patrons. Actually, after the shows, we hang out for 30 minutes there and chat. If you're a patron and would like to join us today, we'll be there in a couple minutes, as a matter of fact. Other things, discounts on merchandise, things like that.
Yeah, and we'll also be previewing or premiering our new show, The Big Bad, on that very Discord channel. So definitely join us if you can.
And that is only about 2 weeks away. The premiere episode of The Big Bad will be Tuesday, October 13th. So yeah, if you're a patron, please join us. Yeah, I know. So we're still... they're still editing. There's still scraps of film flying around the editing room and certain debates and things like that for our upcoming tournament, celebrity-filled D&D tournament show, The Big Bad, coming on October 13th. So definitely, if you haven't subscribed on YouTube, please do so at the moment. You know, Paul, we just zoomed past 500 subscribers on YouTube much faster than we planned on, actually, and that just seems to be continuing to happen. That's super super encouraging, as a matter of fact. Love to see really that. Is.
Yeah.
And if you have to follow us on YouTube, and you'll get notifications for when the Big Bad episodes are finally done and released.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's subscribing on YouTube or joining our Patreon, I just want to point out these things help us not only financially, but emotionally as well. It is definitely a real morale boost to us to see those things happen and keeps us making awesome content for you. So if you're enjoying it, please subscribe. Please join our Patreon if you can. And we will continue to pump it out for you.
Definitely. You want some backstage hints and secrets about creating The Big Bad? Please tune in Tuesday night at 8 for our Developer's Diary, where we're going to hash out what Paul and I have been working on this week. Do check in. I think, Paul, you have a new 10 Dead Rats coming up Thursday night before
Should
Critical
be.
Role.
Yeah. We unfortunately got canceled last week, so hopefully we will be back this Thursday.
Great. Anticipating that greatly on my end here. And of course, don't forget that we are live with the talk show every Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope that you will join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.